there. This is Positive Outcomes, a podcast for the O&P community. Thank you for joining us. I'm Simon Beals, your host for this episode. We have a great show for you. We have Dr. Chris Cowper-Smith joining us today. He's the president and CEO of Spring Loaded Technology, and we're going to be discussing how treating knee osteoarthritis is not as straightforward as it used to be. Chris comes to us from a neuroscience background, associated with Dalhousie University, and started Spring Loaded Technology back in 2012. 3 years later, Spring Loaded brought to market the Levitation Osteoarthritis Knee Brace, and in 2019, the company introduced the Levitation 2. Spring Loaded is based in beautiful Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. Welcome, Chris. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us.
Thanks so much, Simon. It's wonderful to be here.
So I'm always fascinated to learn kind of the evolutionary path that individuals have taken from kind of where they started to where they've landed and where they are today. So your background is in neuroscience. What was the title of your PhD dissertation?
My PhD dissertation, the title was, What's Your Next Move? Multiple spatially defined response biases affect consecutive eye and arm movements. And believe it or not, that's supposed to be a reasonably accessible title, but I understand it's quite cryptic as well. So in broad strokes, my graduate work was focused on understanding how the human brain controls movement of the eyes and arms. And we used a wide variety of approaches, including brain imaging and behavioral research, to help characterize how first a healthy human brain controls normal function. And we wanted to do that to understand, well, how the healthy brain works, to define benchmarks ultimately for patients going through rehabilitation as they work to recover normal function. So in other words, we have to understand how the normal system works if we ever want to have a hope of helping someone recover to something that looks like normal. And then in parallel, during my graduate work, I was trying to apply this research that I was doing in the real world in more of a clinical setting. And so I worked with patients having chronic movement disabilities in two different ways. The first was as a volunteer at the Nova Scotia Rehabilitation and Arthritis Center, where I worked hands-on with patients going through a range of different rehabilitation protocols. And the second was by developing and systematically testing new rehab protocols for patients with chronic stroke impairments. And that's where we were looking to try and make an individual, for example, with stroke, recover to a point that would look something like the normal system and recover the core principles of movement control and coordination that you see in the normal system.
So obviously it was a clear and linear path that took you from that to developing a company that produced a product for looking at managing tricompartmental OA in the knees. Have I missed any steps in between?
It definitely wasn't a clear jump from point A to point B. And I often wonder how everything unfolded. But
So how did you transition? What got you into where you are now?
Well, my career plans shifted, to your point, pretty dramatically as I went through grad school. Originally, I thought I'd stay the course, finish my master's, my PhD, maybe a postdoc or two, and then apply for a faculty position at a university somewhere. But the funny thing about grad school and being trained by individuals who went that course before you to become professors and hold faculty positions is that that's often all they know. And they're incredibly bright human beings that are at the forefront of all kinds of amazing research that helps change the world. But I remember going through, for example, at a conference and trying to decide what I wanted to do next and attending a career panel session. And I think this was the Society for Neuroscience. And the panel provided a message that after grad school, your three options included something like, you know, academia, become a professor, maybe become a journal editor for a scientific journal, or perhaps work for a pharmaceutical company. And so, you know, obviously pretty narrow lens. And as I went through grad school, I found that my research was really interesting at an academic level or an intellectual level, but I ultimately felt it was too far away from the real world. And I was tired of seeing people with chronic movement disabilities suffer without new solutions coming. And so I decided to expand my horizons a bit. I took a couple of entrepreneurship courses through the Faculty of Business and identified a huge unmet need for movement disability and ways that we could potentially solve those issues. And from there, the rest was history.
So how did you transition to specifically knee osteoarthritis? How did that come about?
Well, a key insight for me was, so sorry, Simon, the transition from neuroscience to knee OA, specifically that interest.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're kind of examining what you want to do with your life and kind of broadening out your scope to founding a company predominantly directed towards managing knee osteoarthritis. Now, where was that jump?
So in kind of marrying my academic interests in grad school with, you know, my volunteer work and trying to help people with movement disabilities and so on, I started thinking in much more detail about how these two things were related and how my training might provide some value. And a key insight for me was that we need to be thinking about movement disabilities in a much more holistic way. The brain and body are intimately connected through the nervous system, and we shouldn't be thinking about musculoskeletal issues without considering how the brain and nervous system are involved. And on the flip side, we shouldn't be thinking about neurologically originating movement disabilities without considering the role of the musculoskeletal system. So I'll give you a couple examples that works and how I was thinking about this.
Sure.
The first was that with stroke patients who I was working a lot with, many of them experience heightened muscle tone and spasticity. And these individuals don't just have a tight muscle. Their muscle is tight due to an imbalance between inhibitory and facilitatory signals descending from the brain through the spinal cord to the muscles. And to treat spasticity secondary to stroke, we need to take an integrated approach to rehab, which is now often referred to as neural rehabilitation or functional neural rehabilitation. And this will often involve physiotherapy, functional electrical stimulation, perhaps even mental imagery practices, and even robotic therapies in a way that considers the underlying neurological origins of the issue rather than just trying to treat the tight muscle. And it's important that when doing this, we kind of consider the principles of neuroplasticity, that is how the brain can rewire itself or learn to rewire itself to compensate or overcome the issue. And when you take that more integrated approach, you'll have much better outcomes, both for recovering movement and also overcoming things like spasticity. Now, when it comes to patients with arthritis, which is a disease that's classically been considered musculoskeletal in nature, research has shown a very intimate connection between the brain, spinal cord, and body in the typical progression of the disease. And this connection between the nervous system and body underlies negative feedback cycles that perpetuate or accelerate the impacts of the disease and prevent efforts to at least slow it down or ideally rehabilitate and restore normal function. So there's so many examples here. You know, pain doesn't just occur in the joint. It occurs in the brain due to a stimulus that you feel somewhere in the body, which is then transmitted to the spinal cord and the brain through sensory nerves. And in the case of OA, chronic pain experienced in the joint is transmitted to the spinal cord, then the brain, and in the spine. This can often result in a reflexive feedback cycle where pain causes an inhibitory signal to be sent back to the muscle by the spine, which is often called arthrogenic muscle inhibition. And in the case of knee OA, this leads to quadriceps activation failure. So you're unable to activate the quads to the same level that you would be otherwise, because basically you're experiencing pain and your nervous system is saying, ow, that hurts, let's turn that off to avoid the pain. So it creates this negative feedback cycle where you have pain that leads to a reduction in quad activity that in turn can lead to increased joint loading, which can cause more pain. And so the cycle just rages on. And you often see this in patients with OA as they progress.
So when you, based upon kind of that background of kind of the neurology associated with, you know, patients suffering from OA, how did that kind of direct you towards kind of an intervention, a management tool such as the levitation in actually addressing those issues within a patient? Was there research in that area previously? You know, I know all the PhDs I know love to dig deep into the literature. What did you find when you kind of looked for that? You know, was there kind of research out there that really bridged kind of that neurology that you just described to actually prompting the idea of developing a new orthotic device?
For sure. So in many ways, that sort of insight that, you know, arthritis isn't just a musculoskeletal condition, that you have to also treat issues that originate in the brain or the spinal cord, led me to believe that I could have a potential impact and develop a solution that considers both of those things. And so when looking at the principles of neural rehabilitation, principles of practice and of the right level of dosing and, you know, repetition of movements in ways that the brain can learn from, it led me to believe that we could create a tool that patients could use in their everyday life to not only avoid pain and help overcome musculoskeletal issues, but also help the brain learn that it's safe to activate the muscles, for example, that it's able to activate the muscles with a positive outcome, such as, you know, extending the knee while weight bearing. And that in doing so, it's not any longer causing this reflexive cycle to shut off the muscles.
Did you expect to find that in the literature, or was that something that kind of surprised you?
It's definitely something that I was familiar with through some of the work I was doing on neurologically based movement disabilities, but which hadn't been fully applied to a lot of the musculoskeletal issues that you see treated through more sort of classic ways, if you will.
Okay. So that actually kind of very well kind of leads into kind of next kind of area I want to talk to you about is specifically about tracheomompartmental osteoarthritis and how we manage that from an unloading perspective. When patients, you know, are given a diagnosis of, you know, patellofemoral OA or multicompartmental OA, what are the choices? What are their, you know, what does it look like for them in terms of a prognosis?
So this is where we started to get really excited from sort of the entrepreneurship side of this. There was a huge unmet patient need in specifically that space. When we look at the treatment guidelines and prognoses for patients with different types of OA. And so, as we know, osteoarthritis is broken down typically into four stages, from doubtful to mild to moderate to severe. And as you progress through those different stages, you have increasing things like bone spurs, degeneration of the cartilage, narrowing joint space, and often significantly increasing pain, loss of function, and in some cases, even disability. So ideally, we want to be catching these patients and all patients with osteoarthritis early in the conservative phase. And conservative interventions, which include things like education, exercise, and strategies for joint unloading, when applied early, can allow patients to delay the progression quite markedly or even halt the progression of the disease. And they're able to remain functional and relatively pain-free for a very long time. Now, if conservative treatments don't work, you know, then you go down the pharmacological route and the surgical route. The problem that we saw was that across the conservative and surgical routes, there really weren't great solutions for people in particular with patellofemoral OA or more broadly anterior knee pain. And that was because traditional knee braces, for example, are only designed to help treat the tibiofemoral joint and don't do anything at all to unload the patellofemoral joint unless the patient has a misaligned patella, which some do. And in that case, you can try and realign it. But there's no brace that actually will unload the patella. And as we talked about earlier, because other conservative treatments like weight loss and so on are so difficult, these patients don't have a lot of great solutions. So then they end up taking drugs, which can be great for pain, but come with unwanted side effects, in particular gastrointestinal. And then surgical. But the problem is when you get to the surgical intervention, which is intended only for a few patients, you don't want every patient to get there. Patellofemoral replacements or patellofemoral resurfacing interventions are difficult and have mixed outcomes, highly variable outcomes at best. In fact, many surgeons won't even touch the joint because they don't have great results from it. And so unfortunately, patients with patellofemoral issues or multi-compartment issues often faced a kind of a bleak prognosis. And that's where we wanted to design something that could be used early on in conservative care to help these patients prevent or delay the progression of the disease.
What can you tell us about tricompartmental OA?
For sure. If we think about arthritis broadly, and I know this audience will be very familiar with this, you know, it's one of the most common causes of disability worldwide, and OA can occur in any of the three different compartments within the knee. But historically, that was something that was actually underappreciated. And one of the best studies on this was actually from Duncan and colleagues in the Journal of Rheumatology almost 15 years ago. And they had a couple of really interesting insights about arthritis, or knee osteoarthritis specifically. And what they did is they looked at the standard radiology practices that are used to diagnose patients with arthritis. And what they showed was that in a population of individuals who are known to have knee arthritis, they looked at how the arthritis would be diagnosed by clinicians using different types of radiographs. And the reason they were doing this is that historically, clinicians in radiology departments only used what's a posterior anterior view of the knee. So taking a picture of the knee head on. And when that's done, around 60% of patients with knee OA will be diagnosed correctly with arthritis and will miss about 40%. When they add in one more view of the knee, for either from the top, a skyline view, or the side, a lateral view, that just by adding that one more view, they'll catch another 30% of patients, bringing the total patients diagnosed correctly to 90%. And then if they add in all three views, they'll get close to 100%. And so the first insight was that through standard radiology practices, we were traditionally underdiagnosing the prevalence of knee OA. But the second and even more striking finding was that when you apply these practices to an adult population of individuals with knee pain, and they looked at a group of 800 people with knee pain, with just that first view, the posterior anterior view, they would diagnose around 40% of those patients with knee pain as having tibiofemoral OA, because you can only look at the tibiofemoral joint with that view. But when they add in skyline and lateral views, they'll diagnose just 4% of patients with isolated tibiofemoral OA, 40% with combined tibiofemoral and patellofemoral OA, and then another 25% will have patellofemoral alone. And then the remaining individuals were normal, since this was a population of individuals with knee pain. And so the key insight from this was that in quite a striking way, the prevalence of tibiofemoral OA had been wildly overestimated in the past on its own as isolated tibiofemoral OA. And in fact, the patellofemoral OA is much more common.
So when we look at that, so now we have kind of a condition that has been underrepresented. How did that direct you towards kind of coming up with a solution or an approach to managing that particular presentation?
The second sort of key thing that happened when we were looking into this and trying to figure out what solutions might work was that, you know, after realizing that patients with multi-compartment or patellofemoral OA had been historically underrepresented or underdiagnosed, and certainly undertreated because there's a lack of efficacious treatment options that are conservative or even surgical for individuals with patellofemoral OA, what we wanted to do was look at, okay, well, what works? What's out there? And what are the standard practices and clinical guidelines saying about managing knee OA? And those practices show that, you know, some common principles exist for conservative care. Exercise, physiotherapy, staying active, you know, movement as medicine, education, awareness, and self-care. And then a number of different strategies for unloading the joint. And this can happen through activity modification, which unfortunately means for a lot of people giving up the things they love, weight loss, traditional knee braces, and assisted devices. And the insight there is that the joint unloading was huge when we were looking at this. And so we started thinking about whether or not it could be applied to help these patients with patellofemoral and multi-compartment disease who didn't have a lot of great intervention options, a lot of conservative options that are efficacious. And so what we saw was that for these patients, weight loss is one of the most effective options. You know, if you lose weight and a significant amount of weight, you're going to have improved pain and function. But the problem with it is that it's extraordinarily difficult for patients to accomplish a meaningful amount of weight loss when they're in pain. And so one of the studies done on this in arthritis care and research by Messier and colleagues was they looked at what the effect of weight loss is, and this played a big impact in how we designed the brace. So there's a dose response to weight loss in terms of outcomes for patients with knee OA. So if an individual loses 5% of their starting body weight, they'll have almost no effect. It won't improve outcomes. If they lose 10% of their starting body weight, they'll start to have improvements in physical function, physical health, mental health, quality of life, and even inflammatory markers. But 20% of a weight loss from their starting body weight was the most efficacious and beneficial for these patients. So we started thinking about that, and for a 200-pound individual, which is the average weight of someone with arthritis, That's a 40-pound number that they have to hit. They have to lose 40 pounds of weight in order to achieve a 20% weight loss, which for most people is just incredibly unrealistic. So we started thinking about that and saying, you know, this clearly is an effective treatment, but it's hard for people to realize. So how can we make it easier for them? And that's where we started thinking about what we could do with a knee brace. You know, traditional knee braces are focused on stability, which is a classical musculoskeletal focused approach. They aren't focused on mobility, which starts to introduce some of the more neuro rehabilitation principles. And they aren't focused on absorbing body weight or reducing loading in the knee across all compartments of the knee. So what we wanted to do in a nutshell was create a brace that could reduce joint loading or effectively the amount of body weight going through the knees.
So simple question, how does the LEB2 achieve that?
So
complicated answer, simple question.
There was many years of R&D into this. And originally, I got to say, I thought this was a really simple solution. You know, let's throw some strings on a knee brace and use them to absorb body weight when someone goes into flexion and to assist mobility when they're trying to extend the knee. And in doing so, we had good reason to think that this would reduce joint loads in a nutshell, because the springs would be absorbing body weight when the individual is in flexion and therefore transferring it away from the knees. So that was kind of one of the original simple ideas, that if we could do this, you know, maybe this would be a proxy for body weight loss that would be beneficial. In reality, there were a whole bunch of challenges to making that happen. But in the end, what the brace does is we have these liquid springs embedded inside the frame of the knee brace that absorb potential energy as you go into flexion. They absorb body weight, and then they assist extension, which is, again, effectively reducing the amount of weight going through the knee as you go through that range of motion. The longer answer is that in terms of the mechanism of action of this, through further research that we've done on it, is that we are reducing the tensile forces placed on the knee by the quadriceps as you go into flexion and as you extend your knee. And by reducing those tensile forces, which are the number one predictor of joint forces, we're able to reduce loading within the knee.
So many products are brought to the market, you know, based upon a good idea. I guess one of the benefits of having a PhD at the helm of a company is that you love to research. So what is the research out there that supports, you know, what you've done from your conceptual idea to the actual kind of production of the Levitation 2?
So how does it fit within the research?
Yeah, I mean, we've gone from theoretical to an actual device. Can you speak to the research that supports kind of your original hypothesis?
For sure. So the research on the brace specifically, is that what you're getting at?
Both. Yeah, absolutely both. So, you know, you've got the premise behind this, what you want to achieve. Now, what does the research say? Since you've developed Levitation 2, now how you've tested it and actually supported it from kind of a theoretical model and advancing through now to kind of actual patient studies.
So the first sort of principle there had been, you know, we knew that weight loss was an efficacious intervention for patients with knee OA. And so if we create this brace that would basically mimic weight loss, we could hopefully get some of the beneficial outcomes that are associated with weight loss. And in fact, what we wanted to do was break that cycle of arthrogenic muscle inhibition that we talked about before, where patients are experiencing pain, and then that leads to shutting down the quadriceps, which leads to weakness, and so on. And so we wanted to create a product that could break that cycle by assisting people, reducing pain, and then allowing the brain to actually activate the quadriceps, which perhaps counterintuitively allows the patients to strengthen. And so one of the key insights in literature now is that by assisting knee extension, you see incredibly improved outcomes in patients with arthritis, knee osteoarthritis, related to function, gait, quality of life, and so on. And perhaps most importantly for many individuals that are worried about providing the extension is that these patients are also gaining strength, quite significant levels of strength. So that's one of the key things in terms of how this fits into the research, is that by assisting knee extension, you're actually able to enable patients to be more active and gain strength versus being sedentary.
So how does
go ahead.
How does that then compare to the more current conventional method of knee braces and managing patients with OA.
So traditional braces for knee OA, the most common would be a unicompartment offloader, which is applying a force to the side of the knee to help correct a varus or valgus misalignment of the knee. And by doing so, you're able to realign the knee and redistribute forces from one side of the tibiofemoral joint to the other. And so this is, again, a classic musculoskeletal kind of approach. Let's, you know, correct that alignment and address the sort of structure of the knee to or the alignment of the knee to redistribute joint forces and then hopefully reduce pain for these patients. And those are quite effective for patients that have unicompartment tibiofemoral OA, which is, as we talked about earlier, a small fraction of patients with knee osteoarthritis. So the key difference for us is that by absorbing body weight, we're not just providing unloading in one compartment of the knee, we're actually providing unloading in all three compartments of the knee, the patellofemoral joint and both tibiofemoral joints.
And is there research that you've been involved with, kind of using patients with the levitation II knee brace to support kind of the unloading versus the offloading approach to managing their pain?
Absolutely. So to date, we've done four key studies that I'll talk about, and then there's a couple others that are in progress as we continually work on building out a really strong evidence base. But the first two studies were both biomechanical modeling studies. And the first one was actually done by us internally when we were designing the brace. And then we went out and had it validated externally by independent collaborators. So the first study used a biomechanical model to simulate the effects of the knee brace. And again, this was in the design phase to determine if, is this a good idea? Is this going to work and actually reduce joint forces as we kind of expected it to? And so what we did is we took a model, which is had been validated and was reliable predictor of knee joint forces when you go into a deep knee bend. And those forces are predicted essentially by body weight as well as external and internal moments or forces that are trying to bend or straighten the knee. So, you know, body weight and gravity try to bend the knee, and then the extensor mechanism, the quadriceps, try to extend the knee. And if you know body weight and you know the rough size of someone, the weight and dimensions of them, as well as the position they're in, you can calculate the forces that will happen inside the knee in a reliable way. And so what we did is we took that model and we added in the forces applied by the levitation brace. And out of that predicted that for someone at a 90-degree knee bend, so they're just, for example, starting to stand up from seated, we would be providing the equivalent reduction in joint forces to what would be achieved by losing 45 pounds of body weight. And so for a 200-pound person, that would be, you know, 22.5% of their starting body weight, which was right in that range we wanted to be in based on the weight loss studies. Now, that was a really simple model and we did it internally. And, you know, most people want to see external studies or validated independently. And so what we did is we went to the University of New Brunswick and spoke to a biomechanical researcher there who had a much more sophisticated model that could look at knee joint contact forces across the range of motion as someone was moving. And most importantly, the model had been validated against the forces that are actually observed in an individual with an instrumented total knee replacement. So you're able to take this model and run different scenarios through it. And the normal forces that are occurring were predicted, were predicted what actually occurred in an individual with an instrumented knee replacement. So what they did is they took that model and they, again, incorporated the force output of our brace, this time across the entire range of motion of the knee. And they looked at a wide range of anatomical structures, including the tibiofemoral joint, patellofemoral joint, patellar tendon, the quad tendon, the ACL, and the PCL. And they saw a significant reduction in tibiofemoral and patellofemoral contact forces, starting around 15 degrees of flexion and peaking around 90 to 100 degrees of flexion for both the tibiofemoral and patellofemoral joints. And then similarly, a reduction in patellar and quadricep tendon forces. And then finally, there was no effect on the ACL and a slight unloading effect for the PCL. And so those were the biomechanical studies we initially did to validate the unloading capacity of the brace.
And you'd mentioned that there's kind of some ongoing research that's taking place now.
Yeah, so there's two more studies that have been completed, which I'll mention briefly, and then a couple of other studies that are ongoing. We, you know, modeling research is fine, and it's quite useful to get things off the ground, but we wanted to validate this in patients with knee osteoarthritis and individuals with multi-compartment knee OA specifically. And so the University of Calgary did a study looking at patients with knee OA in a number of different tasks, and these tasks included chair rise and lower, walking, stair ascent, and descent. And they looked at 3D kinematics, ground reaction forces, electromyography, and did a more traditional kind of inverse dynamics approach to calculating from the bottom up what the forces would be inside the knee. And so they further extended these modeling results, showing that the brace reduced the required knee extension moments generated by the quadriceps to actually achieve extension. This was happening because of a reduction in quadricep forces, both of these things being key predictors of joint loading. And then most importantly, that these changes were associated with significant reductions in pain reported by the participants in each of the tasks studied. The final study I'll mention that's been done was a clinical outcome study, and these were patients with any pattern of knee OA. So unlike traditional studies on knee braces that have focused only on around the 4% of patients who have true unicompartment tibiofemoral OA, we included everyone with OA, whether they had patellofemoral OA, unicompartment TFOA, or multicompartment OA. And we looked at their outcomes after using the brace for a minimum of 1 month. And what we found was, regardless of the pattern of knee OA that they had, the brace provided significant beneficial effects for quality of life, for function, for reductions in pain. But notably, the effects were most pronounced for people with patellofemoral involvement in their arthritis. And so that was quite an exciting finding for us, because patellofemoral joint has been historically, as we talked about earlier, underdiagnosed, and there's a lack of beneficial treatment options for patients with patellofemoral issues.
Interesting. And the research that's ongoing now, where is that going?
So there's a number of different studies ongoing now. We are doing, for example, internally, we're doing a patient registry. We're absolutely committed to evidence-based outcomes and to ensuring our users are getting the most out of the brace and getting the best benefits of the brace. And so we enroll every patient we can into a registry. So in other words, if they're willing, we're collecting data on them. And we get their baseline data, we get their outcomes on pain, function, quality of life, physical activity, and so on at 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, and beyond. And so we're tracking everyone who uses the brace, and then looking at their individual outcomes from a customer support point of view, then also using the data to help inform future product improvements to make the brace even more beneficial for a wider range of individuals. So that's something we're doing in-house. Externally, our collaborators at the University of Calgary are doing exciting studies using dual fluoroscopy, for example, to actually image the knee in real time as it goes through a deep knee bend or goes up and down stairs to look at joint loading. And we have other collaborations that are being initiated to look at the brace and its role in rehabilitation following different surgical interventions, as well as orthobiologics, injections to the knee and that kind of thing.
So is there a profile that you would say for kind of a typical Levitation 2 user?
So the hitting the nail on the head seems to be individuals who have knee osteoarthritis with patellofemoral involvement and pain that gets worse as they go into flexion. So people that are complaining about knee pain when they stand from seated, when they go up and down stairs, and if it gets worse during those activities, those are the people we seem to have the biggest effects with and the biggest benefits for. That's sort of the gold, sort of the spot on kind of indication. We also see big benefits in a range of other indications that we've just naturally seen over time.
So when you've, you know, given a fantastic kind of research-based evidence, what have you seen kind of anecdotally? Now, when you've had a patient and they've trialed the Levitation 2, what's the reaction? Kind of what, take me through kind of some of the scenarios that you've seen kind of over the past few years with your exposure with Levitation 2.
We've had the opportunity over the last several years to try the brace with really wide range of individuals with different injuries and diseases affecting their mobility and their knee. for patients with osteoarthritis in particular, or pain that gets worse when they go into flexion, which could arise from a number of different indications, the most striking thing is that patients will put on the knee, on the knee brace, and do a deep knee bend or walk up and down stairs for the first time with the brace on and know immediately that it's providing benefits for them. They'll experience an immediate reduction in pain associated with using the brace. And so what we often say is you'll know right away if this brace is going to work with you within the first few minutes even, because the joint unloading effect is immediate. Now, those benefits will continue to get better over time as those patients are using the brace and exercising with the brace, and you know they get the benefits of some of the built-in neural rehabilitation principles of the brace. But the most striking thing is that first moment when they stand up for the first time in 10 years and don't have knee pain.
Any kind of particular cases come to mind for you that were, you know, particularly striking? I like to call them good days at the office. Anything come to mind?
Absolutely. I mean, we've been fortunate to have many good days at the office, and really these patient stories are what keep us going and driven to be working on bringing this product to market. One of the most memorable ones was a couple of years ago, we had an individual who was 86 at the time, and he was an avid hockey player and had been his whole life. And he was starting to notice that his abilities on the rink were declining a little bit, you know, at the tender age of 86. And specifically for him, it was that he had a difficult time when he got knocked over standing back up. And he had a history of different knee injuries, meniscal issues, ligament injuries, and then had arthritis as well. And so his main complaint was, you know, I want to keep playing hockey. I want to play every day for the rest of my life. And right now I'm having a hard time getting up. And so he put on the brace and started playing with it and was able to keep playing hockey for the last couple of years as a result.
Good for him. So, you know, obviously not every day can be a good day at the office. Where have you not been successful with Levitation 2? Have there been any challenges that, you know, that you've come across over the years?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the brace doesn't work for everyone. And some of the challenges have been around sizing. Specifically, we don't currently have brace options for pediatric cases. We've also had some mixed outcomes with certain neurologically based movement disabilities. For some patients, it's been a total life changer and allowed people to keep moving. For others, unfortunately, some of the secondary complications associated with the neurologically based movement disability have been significant enough that they haven't allowed the patient to get the most out of the brace. And so what we think is needed there is that, you know, the brace can play a role, but there needs to be a much more integrated and intentional rehabilitation protocol involving physiotherapy and principles of neurorehabilitation for the brace to work. And then finally,
have you had any kind of interactions or the opportunity to work with kind of some of the rehabilitation experts in the field in conjunction with the Levitation 2?
Absolutely. So on the neuro side or on the arthritis side? Or
Both.
Yeah. So definitely on the osteoarthritis side, you know, we have surgeons that are using the brace as part of their rehabilitation protocols following arthroscopic interventions, debridements, those kinds of things. Also after injections of PRP and so on, and seeing significantly improved outcomes, because to let the joint heal after one of those interventions that are intended to help restore cartilage, for example, you need to unload the knee and you need to give the knee an opportunity to start healing intrinsically. By unloading it, we're allowing synovial fluids to get into the joint space, which helps the knee recover, in particular after one of these interventions, and really get the most out of it. And so this unloading effect has been really exciting for people doing orthobiologics and cartilage restoration kind of procedures. On the neurological side, we are beginning to work with neurologists and others to explore how the brace can be used to help someone rehabilitate from a wide range of different issues. And like I said earlier, we've had some mixed results and are exploring the best ways. But one of the most striking examples there was a patient with muscular dystrophy who was 18 years old at the time. And her outlook was that she was going to continue to degenerate and ultimately be in a wheelchair. And her goal was to be able to cross her graduation stage from high school without needing her canes or crutches. And with our braces, she was able to walk for the first time in years without her crutches and walk across that graduation stage and accept her high school diploma. So stories like that have gotten us really excited about the potential of the brace for neurologically based issues, which is obviously really exciting for me, given my background in neuroscience.
So any kind of diagnostics that you have had experience with, and, you know, besides the OA presentations, kind of in that neurology field, are there any kind of diagnoses of patients where the brace has been applied and you've seen some encouraging results?
So we've seen, again, a wide range of different patients have used it. We've seen benefits in individuals with extensor mechanism deficiencies that can arise from a whole range of different things. It could be an acute injury to the quadriceps tendon or patella tendon. Actually, something that I had suffered from earlier in life was a partial quad tendon rupture. And we've seen it work wonders in those cases. We've seen the brace work in patients who have had their quadriceps removed due to cancer. And we've worked with oncologists to help patients who've had their quadriceps removed walk again. On the neurological side, we've seen benefits in patients with muscular dystrophy, multiple sclerosis, and stroke, and even through your network, some individuals with spina bifida and otherwise.
Interesting. So there's kind of a multi-pronged kind of approach. I mean, it's definitely a broader application than just strictly multi-compartmental OA.
Absolutely. It's been quite striking to see the wide range of interest and that this is truly a much needed intervention for many different patient populations.
So moving forward, where do you see the evolution of the Levitation 2 and spring-loaded technology as you kind of move forward?
We continue to be dedicated to developing innovative orthotic technologies that help people overcome movement disabilities. And that's kind of our core purpose as a business. So we see Levitation 2 being refined, you know, it'll be sleeker, lighter weight, all these kinds of things while still providing the same core functional benefits to patients. We see specializations of the brace to address the different patient populations that we've talked about so that it's more accessible and more optimized to those patients. And some examples of how we'll do that include changing the force response profile across the range of motion, or even reversing it to assist flexion rather than extension, which can be useful in certain cases. And we also see ourselves expanding into other joints in the body. And so we recently started work on a back brace and are now selling a back brace and see ourselves also expanding to the hip and ankle.
Interesting. I could obviously an interest in discussing that one day when it's available. But to close out, any suggestions for our clinicians in terms of how they can, begin to integrate the Levitation 2 knee brace kind of into their orthotic practice?
We've spoken to hundreds, if not thousands, of clinicians over the years now, and we commonly hear a bit of a hesitation to try something new. And there's a bit of a mentality sometimes of, you know, we'll wait and see if this is still around in a few years and then we'll try it. And I guess the good news is we've been around for quite a few years now, but really it comes back to trying it to believe it. You can look at the science, and we've done some great research, and we continue to do great research, but the way to integrate it is just try it with some patients. Identify a few patients that sound like good candidates that, you know, might have pain when they go into flexion that gets worse, and we'll send you out a sample brace. The patient can try it, and if they don't like it, they can simply return it with no risk to them and no risk to the clinic. And through that sort of trial process, we've seen a number of clinicians come on board and really get excited about it and actually really expand the usage of it across different types of indications.
That's fantastic. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to talk with us. Very much appreciated.
Thanks, Simon. It was great to be here.
And so with that, I would like to thank everybody for listening. Of course, as always, if you have a show or a topic of interest that you'd like to hear about for future episodes, you can email us at positiveoutcomes@orthoped.ca. New episodes are released every other Thursday at positiveoutcomes.ca or wherever you get your podcast. Positive Outcomes is a production of Orthoped ULC in conjunction with our partners and is produced by Jonathan Stone and Frederic Sauvé and hosted by myself, Simon Beals, and Jeff Newell. Thanks again for listening. Thank you again, Chris. Until next time.